Blog Talk Radio.
Radio. I'm your host, Michael Dove, and here in the studio today, we have Connie Messina. Connie Messina, Master Social Work, Master MS, in counseling, is an educator with over 30 years of experience teaching and counseling children of diverse backgrounds in the K-12 school system. She has also taught graduate students at the San Diego State University, the University of San Diego, and the University of North Dakota. Connie is also a former Counselor of the Year for San Diego County, past president of the California School Counselors Association, and the president of the California Counseling Association. She is the author of Brain-Friendly Guidance, Activities to Build Emotional Intelligence, and is the producer, director of the documentary film From the Outside Looking In, The Crisis of Illiteracy in America. She's here today in Dove Studios to talk about the problem of illiteracy in America. I'm very happy to have you here. Welcome, Connie.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And congratulations on your show.
Well, thank you very much. It's going wonderfully, and I'm very, very pleased with it. And I'm very pleased and honored to have you here. And I've been wanting to interview you for a long time now. And
thank you. I think it's quite an important topic, and it doesn't get talked about enough.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. So, illiteracy. It's not something that most Americans really think about a lot. So I would just want to hand the mic over to you and have you tell us, you know, what is this issue, this problem with illiteracy in America?
Well, most people don't know that we have over 34 million Americans, adult Americans, who cannot read. Mm. And these are people who were born in America, speak English, and just went through our school systems and never learned how to read. And it's understandable that a lot of people don't think about it. I didn't really either until one of my good friends confided in me that he could not read.
Mm.
And it's something that people are ashamed of, so they don't usually tell anyone.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I can imagine how shameful that must feel in this society that puts such a premium on success and being out there and engaging in the world.
Well, the reason I titled my documentary from the outside looking in,
mm-hmm.
is because all of these adults really can't access, you know, the American dream. They mm-hmm. really are left out on the outside. And as John Corcoran, who has been a national advocate for literacy for over 20 years now, says that illiterate adults are the fastest growing subculture in America today.
Wow, wow. And tell us a little bit, who is John Corcoran?
John Corcoran was a man who was a teacher for 17 years in
mm-hmm.
California and was illiterate. While he was teaching.
Oh, my goodness.
And he finally broke down when he was about 48 years old and went into a library and confided in the people there that he could not read. And so when he started to learn to read, Pat Lindemood heard about him and came and mentored him and taught him further, got him reading on about a 12th grade level.
Uh-huh.
And then he wrote the book, The Teacher Who Couldn't Read,
mm.
which came out in 1995.
Oh, okay.
In which he, you know, made a plea to America to address the problem.
Oh, okay.
And he's been an advocate ever since, and I met him, and we've been working together for many years now.
Mm, okay. Okay, very good. And let's see, can you tell us a little bit about who Lindemood?
Pat Lindemood. Pat Lindemood? Yes, was a speech pathologist.
Oh, okay.
And she teamed up with Nancy Bell, and they developed the Lindemood Bell reading process. And they have clinics all over the country
uh-huh.
and are very successful.
Oh,
successfully
okay.
teaching people to read. So the fact that our K-12 schools cannot figure out how to teach kids to read is just shameful because
yeah.
the research is there, the methods are there, and for some reason, we're still, I've been in several school districts now, still using a form of whole language to teach reading.
Okay.
Which doesn't focus enough on phonics.
Okay, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, very good. Well, let's kind of back up a little bit, because
okay.
I want to know, because it's so, so perplexing, how is it that there are so many adults in this country who cannot read? How did that happen? And what are some of the statistics around that? Because from what I've heard before, it's like a national tragedy that doesn't get talked about. So how did we get here?
Yeah, it is a national tragedy. And I think it's because somebody called it the no-care attitude.
Mm, okay.
That, you know, people who are educated and can help their children, they make sure that their kids get what they need.
Yes.
But you have all these other children in the schools who may not have parents who are sophisticated enough to know what's going on. Their kids get labeled as behavior problems,
uh-huh.
lazy, don't care, and they kind of get shuffled off, suspended over and over.
Yeah.
And then you have this, what they're calling the pipeline, the school to prison
pipeline. Yeah.
Once these kids start getting expelled from school, they're on the spiral downward, and they're out on the streets, and
uh-huh.
next thing you know, they're getting arrested for juvenile things, and then that just leads
yeah.
to more
yeah.
and more problems.
Yeah.
The statistics, the National Institute for Literacy will tell you that 70 to 80% of adult prison inmates cannot read.
My goodness.
Are basically illiterate.
Okay.
About 85% of the kids who are in the juvenile system now have learning problems. So it's not hard to see what happens when kids don't learn how to read. They're not successful in school.
Yes.
And before you know it, they are really pushed out of school. They don't drop out. They're really pushed out.
Okay. All right. And talk a little bit about this connection with illiteracy and crime and criminality.
Well, that's a good question because,
mm-hmm.
Again, the National Institute for Literacy says that adult illiteracy costs Americans $17 billion annually. Why?
Mm-hmm.
Because people who are illiterate, they're usually going to be on the social programs, welfare, food stamps, or in our prisons. They usually develop, and I shouldn't say everybody, but a lot of them develop drug and alcohol problems, domestic violence problems. So all of these social issues that are happening in America can really be traced back to the problem of people who can't master, you can't
yeah.
master the written word. You can't apply for a job. You
yeah.
can't fill out a job application. You can't read a newspaper. And they're lost.
Okay, so in a sense, what you're saying here is that literacy is essential for enfranchisement.
Yes.
Okay. Literacy allows allows participation. The United States, from my understanding of history, has at points used the withholding of literacy and education as a way of shunning and disenfranchising
yeah.
entire segments of the population. And as we all famously know, it was illegal in the United States to teach a slave, a black person, to read.
Right.
So it was under penalty of death or beatings or punishments of that magnitude just for simply reading. So it's like this is something that is unresolved in our collective kind of national DNA.
Right.
My feeling is that what we're seeing in terms of illiteracy and the prison population, the recidivism rates, and all of that, what some are calling the new Jim Crow,
yeah.
Is directly connected to this device, this mechanism of disenfranchisement through illiteracy.
Absolutely. And I don't even think the teachers understand what's going on.
They're not seeing the big picture.
Yeah, they're not seeing the big picture because, I've spoken to a lot of teacher groups, and some of teachers get angry when they hear me speak or they hear John Corcoran speak because they're out there working really hard. A lot
mm-hmm.
of teachers, they're working hard, but they're not working smart.
Yeah.
And in any private business, if you weren't producing and you had results like we're getting in the schools, you wouldn't be in business for very long. And yet the schools are allowed to perpetuate these dismal results
yeah.
that they get.
Yeah, yeah.
And, the administrators are getting these high salaries. Everybody's getting paid.
Yeah.
And all while these kids are failing.
Exactly. And speaking of business, with the advent of corporate privatized prisons, I wonder and I speculate out loud about the preponderance of illiteracy and the maintenance of privatized corporate prisons and the,
yeah.
and the bottom line of the stockholders that invest in them. To me, it's a very, very obvious kind of connection. But,
well, not only prisons, there's a lot of people making money off of the misery of poor people, of uneducated people, unemployed people. Even myself, I'm a counselor,
mm-hmm.
and I worked briefly for the San Diego Urban League and talked with the leaders of the Urban League, and they said, really, if our kids don't learn to read, why should we care about counseling? And they're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
We can't counsel kids to have high self-esteem when they know they don't have the skills to compete
yeah,
or to
yeah.
get a job.
Yeah.
So you kind of have to wonder, all the way from slavery, where why didn't they want the slaves to learn to read? Well, once they became educated,
yeah.
they would be hard to control and to dominate.
Yeah, precisely, yeah.
So even today, you have to kind of wonder if and I'll use the word, there's a conspiracy to keep this underclass and really to not see illiteracy as a huge problem in this country.
Oh, yeah, yes, yeah. Well, I would say that if that were the intent, maintenance of a level of illiteracy would be a very, very ideal tool for that.
Mm-hmm.
But I would like to get into the different styles of learning to read and the different theories behind learning to read, like the difference between phonics and whole brain, whole language techniques, and Linda Mood Bell's techniques and such, in order to kind of get an understanding of that, you know, the what literacy is and how it is to be addressed. If you took kind of help us to understand the terrain in this respect.
Yeah, well, I ended up doing a lot of research on this because in the 8 years that it took me to help my friend get what he needed, which, by the way, he was a veteran.
Okay.
And no one would really listen to us that he needed this specialized treatment.
Yes.
I've heard as much as 200 different types of dyslexia. So there's no one reason why people don't learn to read. But what I found was the reason that this Linda Mood Bell clinic is so successful is they don't call reading a program. They call it a process. Reading is a process. And when they work with people who learn in different ways, they have a very kinesthetic way of teaching reading. It's almost like teaching a deaf person to speak. The students feel the sounds. They feel their throat. They look at their tongue. They see how the tongue is. They learn the sounds of the alphabet. For instance, the P is called a lip popper because your lips pop when you say P.
Yes.
They call the K a tongue scraper because your tongue scrapes the top of your mouth when it says K.
Oh, okay.
So when you feel something, you tend to remember it.
Yes, this is true.
Where a lot of the reading programs that are out there, they depend on kids memorizing things. That will only take you so far. If you feel the sounds and you really get those sounds, then you can decode words for yourself.
Certainly.
And you can learn on your own and you can progress. But what happens is what I'm seeing in those first 3 years of school, they're not teaching reading properly, and then they label the kids failures, and then before you know it, the children just kind of give up.
Oh, okay. And what would you define as an improper way of teaching reading? How is that improper way
happening?
Well,
the whole language movement came along, many years ago, probably 30 years ago. I remember it. I was working in California. And it was more of a memorization of words, saying that, well, if you just give kids a book about something they're interested in, they'll learn to read. And there was not enough emphasis on the mechanics of reading, you say, the phonics, understanding what phonemes are parts of words.
Yes.
Okay? My friend had the same problem that John Corcoran had. And it was called a deficiency in phonemic awareness.
Uh-huh.
Phonemic awareness means you can hear parts of words. So the way the Linda Mood people explained it to me is if I say the word cat, we can hear three sounds. Act.
Certainly, yes.
A person with a lack of phonemic awareness only hears cat. You only hear the one sound.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So what this program does, and I don't get paid by Linda Mood Bell. People have asked me, do you get kickbacks? I go, no, it's just the best program I've seen for teaching.
And neither do I for the rest.
So they do a lot of drill, 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 which gets the brain to start functioning. There are like neural pathways that some of us have that are, it's like a lazy eye.
Yeah.
It's not. It's like any other muscle. It's not functioning well. They do lots of drill to where they get that brain functioning. And they actually do a pre-brain scan and a post-brain scan with their program, and they show that in the pre-scan, there's very little brain activity. It'll be yellow. After they go through these processes, then there's lots of yellow activity.
Yeah.
So the brain actually wakes up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and it's a rather intensive program, and it's expensive. And so a lot of school districts spend all this money on all kinds of stuff, and they don't really make the commitment that they need to make to reading.
Yes, yes. And so for the expense aspect of it, we haven't really got into it. I mean, you made the reference to the multiple billions, but in terms of the expense of an actual program that truly teaches people to read versus the expense of dealing with an individual who is not launched into the society,
the
cost of disenfranchisement on every level, people aren't thinking about those costs, and they're making just from a very, very basic fiscal, from a very basic fiscal perspective, extremely foolish decisions.
Absolutely.
About what to do with people, with,
yeah.
You know, how to handle individuals.
I had a graduate student at San Diego State. I was teaching school counseling, and he said to me, "Why don't people understand the importance of prevention?" And I said, "Wow, if I had the answer to that question."
Oh, yes, yes, yes,
so,
yes, yes.
That's the key.
Yes, exactly. Preventative medicine, preventative social enfranchisement. Which would include nutrition and proper training early on, all of that, which is what this whole radio show is about. You know, as they call it, maximum empowerment radio,
exactly.
Which is why I was so keen on having you here,
exactly,
to talk about this.
And so what I've done is combined both what the information I've learned about teaching reading and literacy with what I was doing as a counselor, and that was building emotional intelligence.
Oh, okay.
Because Eric Jensen, who I studied with for several years, says learning is mind, body, and emotion. So what I try to teach kids is that you also have to take care of your body if you want to be a good learner.
Yes.
You must get sleep. You must drink water. You need to eat good nutrition. And then you need to take care of your emotions. You see, we aren't teaching people this. We're not teaching students how to be a student.
Yes, yes, indeed, yes.
I'll look at some students who are misbehaving in school, arguing with teachers and whatever, and I say to them, "You need to learn how to be a student." And they look at me like, "What do you mean by that?" And I go, "Well, arguing with teachers and getting kicked out of school isn't being a good student. Let me talk to you about that."
Yeah.
And I talk to them about the brain and how the memory and feelings are in the same part of the brain.
Oh, okay.
The limbic system.
Yes.
And that's something teachers need to understand, too. If you can make your class memorable, fun, enjoyable, psychologically safe, where kids aren't embarrassed in class, where there aren't racial or racist remarks made and so on, you know, kids are going to be more interested in learning. But then you've also got to be using the best strategies.
Yes, yes, yes. I'm curious now in terms of the teachers have been kind of saddled with teaching techniques for reading that aren't effective. How do you see that contributing to that phenomenon we call teacher burnout?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I do workshops for teachers, teach classes for teachers, and that's what I tell them. You're all working very hard, but you need to work smarter, not harder.
Yes.
It's almost like there's a battle every day for survival between the students versus the teachers, you see, because the teachers are going to school trying to survive. The students are, in a survival mode.
Yes.
So nobody's enjoying education anymore. I started teaching back in 1970 when we didn't have all these constraints and you could kind of have fun teaching.
Yes.
And I don't see the fun in it anymore for teachers or students. And that's sad. Because learning is lifelong. We're going to be doing it all of our lives.
Well, yes. Learning is another way of thinking about it, in my opinion, is that we're talking about learning needs to be humanizing.
Absolutely.
And it's humanizing.
It's communication.
Yes.
It's connection. So we can get into mental health issues when you don't have connection with other people and you don't feel confident in yourself to communicate. You become more and more isolated.
Yes.
And what I see happening now with all of the electronics is that kids are plugging into their radio, their phones, and their computers, and they don't feel the need to really communicate. And that's driving them further and further into isolation. And I think that's the root of mental ill health.
Yes, certainly. Yes, because the as you touched upon before, the shame, like the shame of illiteracy, it has to have this stifling effect on development, social development, and self-esteem.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you talk to John Corcoran and you talk to Gordon Winder, both are, in my documentary film, they say that they would rather cut up in class than have anybody know that they couldn't read.
Yeah.
So you're mortified, afraid that the teacher's going to call on you and you don't know what to do, so you have to create a disruption. Gordon talks about being, he said, I felt like a ticking time bomb walking around, so angry at teachers, angry at my parents because they weren't helping
me.
Although his parents couldn't help him because his father didn't know how to read.
So
you've got people walking around with anger, and we see it now in America with all this gun violence, with lots of anger, unresolved issues, and inability to succeed in life. And so they're now taking their anger out on others. And we're really in a very scary place because a lot of people are seeing, well, the solution to all the fear is to have a gun. But in my mind, the solution is to have personal skills, people skills, mastery of the language, being able to work. Work is a very wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can feel a sense of accomplishment. Just think of how people feel. They don't even dare go and apply for a job because they can't fill out the application.
Exactly.
I went with Gordon one day to the unemployment office in San Diego. And when we walked in, we were met by a glass wall, basically. All the employment counselors were behind this glass wall, and we couldn't even get to them until we sat down at a computer and signed in. There was a row of computers. So by the time we got to that employment counselor, I said to him, if my friend had come in here alone, he would have walked in the door, saw your row of computers, you all behind the glass, and he would have just turned around and left.
Yes.
As it was, I helped him sign in on the computer. And then when we got to the employment counselor, of course, they had no jobs for him because he didn't read well enough, So there are a lot of, this is why we need to talk about this problem, because when now everyone is realizing about this mass incarceration plan. So if you have 80% of the people in prison who cannot read, and you're going to now take them out of the prisons, well, what are they going to do once they're out of prison? Are you going to give them employment counseling, literacy skills, addiction counseling, and so on, so that they can really make it once they're out? You referred to the recidivism rate.
Yeah.
Very high, because if people can't function in the society, they're just going to go back to these old ways. And if you teach people to read, and then we need to create some jobs programs, you'll see that recidivism rate go down.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, yeah. It's like, I'm just having the thought here. It's kind of like reading is the gateway. It's kind of like a social, it's been used as kind of a drawbridge,
mm-hmm.
you see. And there, and education and reading is like this drawbridge. Recently, they've changed the GED, the general education, the diploma, yeah, the test, and it made it more difficult, so that very few people who apply are able to pass it.
This is what I've heard now from.
Yes.
A program here in our city for people coming out of the jail system, and they tutor them to pass the GED. And they said, I think they've had three people who were able to pass it in
mm-hmm.
a whole semester because they've made the GED test harder.
Yeah.
They've put them on computer again, which is kind of intimidating if you don't
Certainly.
Read well. And then I spoke to someone at the community college who said the same thing. They're having difficulty getting people to pass the GED. What you need to know is you have to read on about a 7th or 8th grade level
yes.
to pass the GED test. So what are we doing for the people who are down there reading on the 2nd and 3rd grade level, if that?
Yes, yes, yeah, yeah. And the GED traditionally has functioned as a way out. It has been through that door, you see, through that door, that process that people have been able to kind of step in,
right.
kind of get on the first rung in terms of jobs and, you know, mm-hmm. in terms of being able to be more full participants. And I tend to question, you know, like the society and the policies that, once again, why I use the term drawbridge, it gets pulled up. And then there's this,
right.
this horrendous moat that individuals are obliged to try to traverse.
Yeah.
They can't do it. So it's
yeah.
like, why are we pulling up the drawbridge on these people?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. You know, you can't even get in the military anymore with a GED.
Yes. And the military was once again one of the great ways out.
Right.
The great
way
through
things.
To this enfranchisement, to step into the American, you know, the American dream,
yeah.
and all of that, and so, so I think what you're doing is very critical, you know, in terms of speaking about literacy, promoting it. What kind of response first of all. Tell me about your presentations that you've done at universities and schools and churches and institutions around the country. And what is that like, and how have people responded to that?
Well, once I learned so much about this problem of
mm-hmm.
literacy, when I was training school counselors at San Diego State University, and I talked about literacy, and I brought John Corcoran in to talk with him, and they said, why should we be concerned about illiteracy? We're counselors. And I said, well, you know all those kids that are being referred to you as behavior problems? The first thing I want you to do is to go and look at their test scores. You know, I want you to look and see that all this acting out behavior could possibly be because they can't do what the teacher wants them to do. And I just spoke to a counselor the other day who is a former student of mine. And he said, and he was many years ago, he was a student of mine, and he said, Connie, now I know why you were always talking to us about literacy. He said, because I'm a counselor in a high school in San Diego. And he said, our kids can't read. And I said, I know. I've spoken to teacher groups, and, you know, they're open to it. I have to be very careful. I don't want to insult them.
Uh-huh.
But I spoke to a group of administrators one time who said, well, there aren't students who get through my school without being able to read. And I said, well, you know, you don't want to argue with people.
Yeah, certainly.
I know in my mind somebody's getting, they're getting through somebody's school.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, maybe not. But, you know, this problem of illiteracy is growing. It's not getting better. It's growing. So obviously we're not doing what we need to do. I've spoken to churches, and I've spoken to nurses groups, and people are interested and they agree, but we can't seem to get the movement going of what needs to happen. I think we must have programs in the community now that go into these communities and offer courses in reading. But what I want to do is you give a stipend to the adult learner to come in. I want it to be like a little job for them.
Mm-hmm.
And people look at me and say, you're going to pay them to go to school? Yeah.
Yes.
Well, it's called a scholarship. It's what we give college kids.
Yes.
We owe it to these adults. They've gone through our system and didn't learn because we didn't teach them in the way they needed to be taught. And so they're out there struggling now.
Yes.
And they're on your welfare rolls and your, you know, food stamp rolls, and everybody's resenting them.
Yes, yes, exactly.
But they're in survival mode.
Oh, certainly, yes. And a lot of the anger that they feel, it's almost as if the society itself blames them and does not allow them even the legitimacy of their anger, I believe, because, you know, the society itself has failed them.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't really say that the society has failed you because it's just
Well, and you know what? A lot of them don't realize it. They internalize it and they think
it's
their
fault.
They're stupid. They can't learn. There's something wrong with them.
Yeah.
So at a certain point, they give up and they don't even ask for help.
Mm-hmm.
We have to do a really major outreach to these people now to bring them in, and that's why I'm thinking the scholarship or the stipend might help, to really bring them in now
to a
program like Linda Mood Bell, or there are other programs now that are doing a good job. But we need to give them the best programs. And people will say to me, well, are you working with the library programs? Well, I've done a bit of research on the library literacy programs, and, you know, they are helping some people. However, they're tutors. They're not teachers.
Yes.
They're volunteers. The students only meet, you know, with their tutor once or twice a week for like an hour or two. That's not enough. What I've seen working in the clinics that are working for people who cannot read is they go every day, 4 hours a day.
Yes, yeah.
And it's intensive. And they're working with trained teachers or
mm-hmm.
trained tutors who know what they're doing.
Yes, yes, yeah.
You know? So I've approached the library programs and I've asked them, I even went to the training in San Diego and I asked them what their success rate is. And none of them have a high success rate.
Yeah.
You know, students drop out
mm-hmm.
because most illiterate people are manual laborers. If they're lucky to have a job, they're cutting trees, they're hauling trash, they're painting. And so they can't afford to miss work in order to go to school.
Yes.
Then who pays the bills? Who buys the
mm-hmm.
food? And this is why I discovered that with my friend Gordon, because he called me one day after I got him a scholarship to the Linda Mood Clinic, and he said, I can't go to school today. And I said, why not? You have to go. You can't make up these sessions, and they're very expensive. He said, I don't have the gas money to get there.
Mm.
You see? So I said, okay. I had a little nonprofit organization at the time. We're going to give you a monthly stipend. I think we gave him $500 a month.
Uh-huh.
So he would have gas so that he could get a little breakfast before he went to school.
Certainly, yes. Yeah.
I mean, that's the right thing to do.
Yes. And so when you're talking here, I'm like sort of listening with an inner ear about the what is underlying here with the issue. And it seems to me that individuals need to feel that they are worthy.
Yeah.
That there has to be an underpinning of a sense of knowing that one is worthy.
Absolutely.
Of even
of the help.
The help of even being engaged in the society.
Mm-hmm.
And and that they are deserved. That they are deserving of the best attention, from the society, and to be in a place where they actually can demand it.
Yeah.
It's like we need to get to a place where we demand it.
Yeah.
And you have to know that you are worth it, worthy enough to demand.
Yeah. As John Corcoran says, many, if not most, illiterate people think that there's something wrong with their brain.
Exactly.
And that they can't learn.
Yes.
But that's not it at all.
No, they've been lied to.
They need to learn in a different way.
Yes.
Than other people, it's very easy for them to learn to read, you see? And they just pick it up right away. But then for some, for those who aren't hearing phoneme, and the teacher saying, look, to little Johnny, sound the word out, sound it out. Well, he can't hear those individual sounds.
Yes.
He doesn't know he's not hearing the sound. The teacher doesn't know he's not hearing the sound. And so there's a lot of wasted time and money going on there.
Yes.
Because, the problem hasn't been identified, you see. So we need better teacher training. We need more of a commitment to literacy, and I thought maybe we need to go to the state legislatures and start with them and talk to those education committees who are sending all these mandates to the school district.
Yes.
And saying, maybe you need to look at a different way when you're anybody can go to a school and ask them for their school accountability report card. In other words, I'd like to see your test scores. How is your school doing? They will see that there's a proficiency rate, which means that the kids read at grade level,
mm-hmm.
and then there's another level behind that, adequate or whatever.
Yes.
And so a lot of the districts will act like it's okay for 40% of their kids to just be at an adequate level, not proficient. And parents need to know how to ask the right questions.
Yes.
What percentage of the kids in your school are reading proficiently at grade level? And you'll see it's not very many.
Mm-hmm.
It's shocking, really, to see that we're operating these schools with, 40% of the kids not reading appropriately.
Yes, and if it were a business or any other kind of serious endeavor, wouldn't stand.
Yeah.
No one would stand for it. So in a sense, it's kind of like we have to be able to demand.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be able to get in people's faces, and this is, I believe, is the era of holding everybody accountable.
Yes.
You see all the institutions.
Yeah.
Must be held accountable, especially the government institutions, especially the ones that are supposed to protect, serve, teach
mm-hmm.
us.
Right.
And so it is our duty, in my opinion, our duty to.
Yeah. Now my documentary is on YouTube.
Yes.
So people can go and look at it.
And there's a link to it in the show description as well.
Okay, good.
So you can go to it.
I will be sending that link to lots of legislators and people, to see what kind of response I get. And I have already talked to a lot of people and have not really gotten a response.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I'm gonna keep, being that little voice in the wind that keeps talking about it. But you know what? Jonathan Kozol really was the first one who brought it up when he wrote the book Illiterate America, 10
uh-huh.
years before John Corcoran wrote his book.
Uh-huh.
He was a teacher in New York, and he was seeing these high levels of illiteracy and he was trying to alert people back then.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And John Corcoran comes along 10 years later, and here we are, you know, 16 years later, and the problem's getting worse. It's not getting better.
Okay, good. Yeah, and perhaps we can put references to those books in the in the show description that's online at on the Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, and
I wanted to give you one more example of
how
illiteracy affects people in their lives. At one point, Gordon, who's the subject of my documentary, was in drug court for his addiction problem.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they talk real fast. They give you directions. They hand you papers. And he's not going to stand up there and say, "Your Honor, I can't read." You know, I, as his advocate, was telling people, lawyers and so on, he cannot read. So one of the papers was all of the things that he shouldn't eat that might turn up in a drug test as a positive.
Uh-huh.
And one of them was poppy seeds. Well, he went, and I knew he was doing very well. He was not using any drugs, and he was faithfully following the program. But he did his weekly drug test, and it came out as a positive drug test. And he went to court, and he called me. I was at home. He was in the court and said, they said my drug test came out positive. I don't know what happened. They now want to send me to jail for the weekend. I said, I'll be right there. I ran down to the court, and I brought a loaf of bread with me that had poppy seeds in it.
Uh-huh.
Because he said, I came out positive for, what is it that's made from poppy seeds? Heroin?
Yes, it's opiate.
Opium.
Yeah.
Yeah. He came out, so I said, oh, I bet it was the poppy seeds. So I went into the court with this loaf of bread.
Yes.
And I said, and he goes, what are you doing? I said, these people understand evidence. I have to show them evidence. And so I said, Your Honor, I think what's coming out positive is the poppy seed in this bread. And the prosecutor said, well, he got a list of things that he wasn't supposed to eat. And that was on the list, so he knew better. And I said, do you remember that he cannot read?
Mm-hmm. See?
So they didn't. They accepted, you know, my explanation.
Oh, yes,
they didn't send him to jail. But how many people have an advocate?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And one can get into kind of like the socioeconomic aspects. You are a voice that could speak to the court, and he's not inclined to be listened to.
Yeah.
He's, you know, they take one look at him and see criminal.
Right.
And that's what, this is the environment that we're in, these are the realities that we're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very, very interested in through our conversation here, it's striking me how very much the issue of illiteracy is such a moral issue.
Yes.
This is a moral issue. That it divides people. It's a societal failing. It ultimately has impact on our democracy itself.
Absolutely.
Because even as Jefferson said, you know, that the democracy depends on an educated electorate.
Yes.
And that people being able to read and have access to information in order to reflect, to make decisions for the welfare, for the well-being of the collective, for the society itself.
Absolutely.
People need to be informed, and you need to have, especially the most traditionally disenfranchised people need the most information. They need the most access. I mean, a lot of our, you know, as an African-American, I know that a lot of our great leaders were transformed by their literacy. Take a Malcolm X and the prison library.
Right.
Spending hours and hours and hours in prison library. Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King graduating college at, I believe, at 16.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is the literacy that lets one.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a tremendous loss of human potential.
Yes.
Is what's happening.
Yes.
And then, too, non-participation in the democracy. If you look at what happened with Detroit, they literally lost their democracy because the state came in, fired all the elected officials, and put a person in charge of the city because things weren't going right. Well, an article came out that said 47% of the adults in Detroit are illiterate, cannot read.
Mm.
So how do you have government, how do you have participation, you see, when that many people can't function, can't read, and are not going to participate because of the shame and the embarrassment?
Exactly, and there's a further dimension to this, because as we've made the connection between illiteracy and incarceration, if you become incarcerated and get a felony, your right to vote is withheld, and this devastates any democratic process when you take entire sections of a demographic of a population and disenfranchise them so explicitly.
You know, we assume that people know things. I ran for my city council. I lived in Poway, California for a while, and I ran for city council. And I didn't win, but I was out talking to people in the park and saying, you know, the first thing I would say to them is, are you registered to vote? Because if they weren't registered to vote, then I had to have a whole different conversation with them.
Certainly.
You know? Yes. And I said, there were like three men sitting at a picnic table, and I said, I'm Connie Messina, I'm running for city council. Are you registered to vote? And one of the men said to me, no, I'm not registered to vote. And I could tell they were probably homeless. And I said, you know, you can just go to the library and register to vote right at the library. And he said to me, how much does it cost? I wanted to cry because I said, it doesn't cost anything to vote. It's free. And I thought, oh, my God, we just assume that people know things.
Yes.
How much does it cost to vote? That was, it just made me so sad.
Yeah.
You know, but happy that I had the conversation with you.
Oh, certainly.
What we've forgotten about in this country is what Chief Seattle talked about, the web of life.
Mm-hmm.
We're all connected in the web of life. What happens to others happens to us. And I don't know if it's capitalism or what, but there's this me, and forget about anybody else hurting.
Yes, exactly.
But they're going to eventually, their life will intersect with your life at some point.
Absolutely.
Whether it's crime, whether it's a disenfranchised person who's going to pick up a gun and shoot a bunch of innocent people because they are, you know, isolated. Or, Michael, one time, years ago, you said to me, and I quoted you in my book, to look at the analogy of the swimming pool. A swimming pool can be a wonderful, exciting, exhilarating place if you know how to swim. If you don't know how to swim, it can be deadly. So look at life. If we have the skills to navigate life and connect with people and enjoy ourselves, it's a wonderful life. If we don't have any of those basic skills, it's a deadly place, scary place, you see. And so when you talk about the moral issue, what are we saying to people? You don't count. We don't care that you're struggling, that you don't even know if you're going to be able to have food for the rest of the month.
Which is why I've been so focused on the issue, the element of empowerment.
Right.
You see, empowerment, that our empowerment is directly tied to the care and enfranchisement of the other, of brothers and sisters, brothers and sisters. That is, this is all, you know, we're all tied together in that way. Okay, and literacy is one of the key means in which that web is created.
Yeah.
It's like how many people, how many minds, how many souls have been liberated through books.
Exactly.
To deny that is to deny something that is utterly sacred from a person.
In fact, there's a quote by George R.R. Martin, and he says, "A reader lives 1,000 lives before he dies. The man who never reads lives only once." So, you know, that says it right there, that if everyone listening could just imagine what their life would be like today if they had never read a book, where would you be today? Probably wouldn't have the job you have or the nice house you have.
Yeah.
You know, so it's important. Everybody needs to get involved and call their congressmen. They can contact us if they're interested. I'm hoping just to get a pilot program going.
Yes, in my town. Yeah, and so to people who can help, even other educators who are listening to this, that want to become active and more informed, how might they get in contact with you?
They can email me at connie@conniemacina.com.
Okay, and then there are there'll be a link in the
description. I would say first go to the documentary and watch the documentary. There's also a link to my website where I talk about emotional intelligence and the importance of emotional intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was Alfred Adler that had two models. How are we doing on time, Michael? he had two models of mental health. One was mental illness and the other was mental health.
Mm-hmm.
The one that was mental health was the sun with rays shooting out, meaning connection.
Yes.
The model for mental illness was a spiral going inward, meaning further and further isolation.
Yes.
Why should we be concerned about that? Because it only takes one person to wreak havoc on society.
Yeah.
The fires in California now, they've found that some of those fires get started are arson. It started. All they have to do, one person who's upset with the world, drop a little match, and there goes California.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what was that quote? I forgot who said it, but they said that if you think education is expensive, try ignorance.
Right. Yeah, and was it Mark Twain that said every time we close a school, we have to build a prison? You know.
Yes.
So education is the key. We want an educated society. I want everybody around me to be healthy and feeling good and caring about me as well as their own family, you see.
Exactly, exactly. And so to kind of wrap it up, it is true, as you said, that an investment in the other, an investment in your brother and sister is also an investment in you.
Absolutely.
Yes. And with that, I say thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yes, I think this is going to really help people get a good grasp of this issue, and I think it's very, very critically important. So I say thank you again. It's been an honor having you.
My pleasure. Thank you.